Today, we travel beyond the Windor.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Beyond the Windor on another episode of a series I guess I'm calling Make Greg Watch Things That He's Never Watched Before. And this is going to be the stop motion episode.
Oh, I wonder who wholly agreed to that idea.
Toby, I'm going to introduce you in a second. Give me a moment.
All right, you can cut that. This is fodder for the outtakes at the end.
No, I'm going to leave you in at this point because this is you. I have to keep every second of you because this is exactly what I've been missing.
He has. I can attest.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you have to keep every second of me because it takes a team of animators their entire workday just to move me at 3 seconds.
Toby, you're already getting in the way of my essay. Let me speak. No.
I'm going to make him regret so much wanting me back, dear listeners.
When looking at any form of non-live-action media, visuals matter more to me. As someone raised on comics, the style of the artist helps to determine if this is something I will even give a chance. I have to enjoy looking at something if that's a major component of the media. And that's probably why in a lot of cases there are animated and stop-motion classics that I have just never watched. In the case of some popular 90s animation, cough, cough, Ren and Stimpy, I'm kind of okay with the stylization turning me off because the story just isn't one I'm likely to care about. But it also means that there are a lot of works out there that are unfairly tarred with the same brush. In the case of something like Paranorman or Chicken Run, that's a legitimate shame, because there is a good story present hidden behind an aesthetic that may or may not appeal. Sometimes the aesthetic of a movie is the primary motivation, A Nightmare Before Christmas being one of them, based on just the show Toby did with Alex and Sharon, talking about how that movie came to life. And that aesthetic may lend itself well to the kind of story it wants to tell. If there is something ultimately true about the work of stop-motion creators, it's that I have a deep respect for the craft. Watching some preparatory material for this show, I learned that in one case, it can take an entire day to do the minute changes required to animate a single minute of stop-motion footage. And that's how much they get done if everything goes smoothly. That feels insane to me, but it means that they have to love doing it, and also be very good at it to make something compelling. They can have great voice talent for their characters, and by and large, these movies do. But someone also has to adjust the bodies and the faces in such a way to convey the proper nuance the voice has. It cannot be drawn, it cannot be computer animated, and it cannot come from the natural ability of a human face. It has to be sculpted. And that requires its own unique set of skills. At the end of the day, I will always stand behind talented artists that make things possible that cannot be done by a human actor. But that doesn't mean that every story they bring to life will be for me. And this episode is meant to be an exploration of when it works and when it doesn't. To help me tell my whys and wherefores, and also to school me on their perspectives, I have brought together Dr. Toby Skeels Jungius, my fellow story explorer with a PhD in stop motion.
It still sounds weird to me that that is accurate.
And my wife, Maureen, who began me on this journey by showing me a stop-motion film I might never have watched on my own, and whose sensibilities when it comes to media are far more visually focused than my own. So, let's begin. We're going to be discussing three movies today, at least two of which most people have heard of, and they are going to be Chicken Run, in the early 2000s by Aardman Productions, the people that did Wallace and Gromit, for those that need that particular pop culture reference there. We're going to be discussing the classic that seemingly everybody but me loves, A Nightmare Before Christmas. And finally, we're going to be discussing the movie that Maureen showed me that I fell in love with seconds after it started playing, Kubo and the Two Strings.
If you must blink, do it now.
Ah! God, that opening! Maureen was watching my face as I was watching it, and she's just like, I've got him hooked.
So to start us off, I didn't want to start with the movie I love the most, and likewise didn't want to immediately come down on the movie that didn't really land with me.
Let's start with one that is more in the middle for me, Chicken Run.
Ever wonder what chickens do when you're not looking?
Operation Cover Up!
No chicken escapes from Tweedy's farm!
You've got to get out of here.
I know our last escape attempt was a bit of a fiasco.
These chickens are planning a little getaway.
The plan is, we go over the wire.
That might work.
Now, they may have found their only hope.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You've been a wonderful audience. The name's Rocky.
And what brings you to England?
Why? All the beautiful English chicks, of course.
Pushy Americans.
Hi, how are you?
Overpaid, oversexed, and over here.
Which bunk is mine?
What is it?
It's a pie machine. Chickens go in, pies come out.
Ooh, what kind of pies?
We're all going to fly over that fence, and Mr. Rhodes is going to show us how.
Did you say fly?
This summer.
I don't want to be a pie.
I don't like gravy.
Rocky!
I'm coming!
From the Academy Award-winning creators of Wallace and Gromit.
Rocky!
Up and down before you can say mixed vegetables!
Dare to dream.
There's a better place out there.
And get ready to fly.
Event of an emergency, put your head between your knees and
kiss your bum goodbye.
Chicken Run.
We mustn't panic. We mustn't panic.
Fair warning, we are going to go deep on these films, so spoiler warning for Chicken Run, Nightmare Before Christmas, and Kubo and the Two Strings.
This is the movie, Toby, that you recommended and sold to me as having a story not unlike one of our favorite New Century novels.
Do you have the slightest idea how little that narrows it down?
The Princess Thieves.
Yes, I did actually realize on revisiting Chicken Run round about the time when the sequel was on the horizon and came out on Netflix. And the sequel's good. I don't think it is at a classic in anywhere the same league. I would put the original one, but then again, the original film is probably one of the most pivotal films I've ever watched because it put me on the path to becoming a PhD doctor, I guess.
That's pretty high praise, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, it was a film I watched when I was 7, 8, I think, when the film first came out. And so, and it was one of those where it put its sense of humor into that slot that my brain had for that. And also it kind of prompted me to ask questions of how was this filmed? How did people make this? And I wouldn't really find out or investigate that more until later when Curse of the Were-Rabbit came out, the feature-length Wallace and Gromit film, which released around the time when we, at least our family, first started to collect DVDs. So it was one of the first films I had where I actually looked into all of the behind-the-scenes material for it. And you see things like how a close-up shot of a foot transforming into the were-rabbit is just, they have the shoe and they have the foot, and the foot is on this long bar that they just push out to reveal it popping out of the shoe. So it is literally popping out of the shoe, but with higher frames than something that you would see elsewhere where they would be animating it a bit at a time. I say that because that is evidence of exactly what I'm talking about. These were the films that prompted me to ask, well, I know that these are made with solid objects, but how do they do that? So for other people, they had Lord of the Rings. And yeah, I also had Lord of the Rings, but the ones that I actually looked at for how did this get created was this film. That led me to Masters in Film Studies. And then when I was like, wait, I can do a PhD in stop motion. How cool. This absolutely will not lead to countless years of anxiety and stress.
That is fascinating to me that your first experience with Aardman's style was actually Chicken Run.
Okay, so like as a feature-length film, Chicken Run, sure, but it was the Wallace and Gromit like shorts that predated that. So I'm afraid I can't say that. Look, I know I'm the stop-motion guy. I'm not crazy. I am also one of those basic bitches that thought of Wallace and Gromit first.
Obviously, you're the one that can talk the most, having done the research into how the animation and all of that works. I can't keep up with a conversation about that because, like, I've seen a few things here and there in terms of what it takes to mold the clay on armatures or the work that they've done, for example, with Kubo and the Two Strings. I've watched some stuff of that now, and all of the painstaking detail they went into in order to make even just the costumes for the characters on the armatures and everything like that. One of the big things that I wanted to get into, not just in terms of is this piece of media a good story in and of itself, but how would you say the art style of Aardman's craft contributes to the telling of the story that Chicken Run wants to tell?
I think the Aardman aesthetic, the art style, is often described as quite whimsical and charming. You know, it's that idea of the soft, toothless, clawless version of Britain that when we like to think of it in its best self, we think of Wallace and Gromit sitting in their lounge that has wallpaper and furniture from a few decades before whatever time period you're watching it, having a cup of tea and some cheese and crackers. That is the most sort of cozy, perfect version of what people would like to think of. But it's, of course, more complicated. Also, I don't think that Wallace was ever responsible for crafting any of the laws of this country. So there is a bit of a gap in the classes we are seeing here versus if we saw Aardman animating The Crown or something like that. A lot of people have that feeling of it. But I actually do think that there is a bit of a darker tone that exists, at least for Aardman of this period. You look at, well, actually, really all of the Wallace and Gromit shorts, there's a sort of dark tone. A lot of the titles, when they drop, have a sort of Hammer horror style appearance of a matter of loaf and death. It's pun crazy, but it's also trying to evoke a horror serial or something like that. And first of all, which of the shorts have you seen? Because there's the original one, which was A Grand Day Out, A Close Shave. No, it was The Wrong Trousers second, and then A Close Shave third. Then they did the feature-length film, which was Curse of the Were-Rabbit, which was when they were partnered with DreamWorks, and so it was published by them. And then they did another short, which was A Matter of Life and Death, which is the most recent one that came out in, like, 2009. It has been so long since there has been any Wallace and Gromit. I think it's the next project they are working on, but for the last decade and change, the face of Aardman has actually been less Wallace and Gromit, and it's been more Shaun the Sheep. Anyway, this is a tangent, one of many that I'm sure I will be so diligent in not going on during the course of this recording.
Also, to actually answer his question, The Wrong Trousers is the only short that I've seen in its entirety. It's annoying because I was watching it for some other reason, not this show, but when I went back to watch more, they were no longer available free on streaming. I have also not seen Curse of the Were-Rabbit. Clearly, I'm going to need to go back and watch more.
To go back to my point, there is darker moments or just frightening moments where the softness and the charm of the characters may contrast with the circumstances and situations that they encounter. A lot of people talk about stuff that used to scare them as kids. For some who I've talked with, it was the dog, no, not that one, in A Close Shave, the one who is the villain of the piece and the final reveal of that one. People were creeped. And if you're watching it now, you would think, but that's hilarious. How can anyone be scared of that? But it is something in just the way it's framed. They understand shot composition, music. There's a great score to it. And of everything that Aardman has done, I think there was one short that I cannot remember the name of, but it involves a sort of a pseudo Hunchback of Notre Dame / Phantom of the Opera style story of someone who works with animals in a theater who is shunned, and an actor takes credit for it. And that one is shocking because there's swear words in it, and it's dark, and it has a grim reaper who plays an organ in it.
That would be the very short stop-motion film Stage Fright, which came out in 1997, produced, directed, and written by Steve Box, distributed by Aardman Productions, and shown on Channel 4. Someone also put it on YouTube, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes.
For the majority of the Aardman canon, Chicken Run is kind of their darkest story. And it's accomplished by contrast, by having this cluster of absolute fucking moron chickens. And I love them. I'm frustrated by them. It's the contrast between Babs, who will say, "Morning, Ginger, back from holiday." "I wasn't on holiday, Ginger. I was in solitary confinement." "Oh, it's nice to get away every now and then, isn't it?" And these are voices which are not necessarily big Hollywood names. They have a Hollywood name. "Oh, I wonder how his name has aged in the time since release and now."
I'm pretty sure he's not in the sequel, is he?
No, it's someone who also absolutely doesn't have any problematic stuff associated with him.
Ooh, okay, good to know.
It's the Shazam actor.
Okay, but Zachary Levi. Yeah.
Like, okay. On the scale, I would say, I'm not going to scale these people. It's just, I would like there to be a Chicken Run film where, like, I don't have to take Rocky and just put the voice in a box and just kind of view the cartoon chicken as just the cartoon chicken. Anyway, a lot of the names are more familiar to UK audiences who would listen to this and recognize, oh, there's this person from that. The original voice actor for Wallace is
Peter Salas, who appears to have a long and storied career, but has never been in anything I've seen, sadly.
He was well known for Last of the Summer Wine, which is, I mean, have either of you heard of that?
Nope. No.
that would be a relatively common UK TV comedy.
A staple
of, I would say, the 80s, like, or something like that. And it would just be a collection of aging geezers in the countryside who would get into various comedic scrapes and things. And he embodied Wallace so much and so well. I'm going all over the map on this. I will come back to your question, which is, how does the art style enhance the story here? It is something that allows you to get drawn in by the charm of the characters. Mm. And then when the contrast of the situation and a lot of the environments in Chicken Run are grim. That chicken farm is made to look like a war prison.
Mm-hmm.
And for a film that you think is quite full of vitality and vibrant, the color palette of the surroundings is black and gray and muted colors. It's the chickens who have a variety of pastels and more bold colors. And Mr. and Mrs. Tweedy are contrasted against that and wearing quite grounded outfits. But
severe, yeah.
Severe. However, there is one exception to that, which is Mrs. Tweedy's entrance. And I cannot think of any other example where someone appears in their first appearance is them in a frilly pink nightgown and feel that terrifying.
Mr. Tweedy, what is that chicken doing outside the fence?
Oh, I don't know, Lorraine.
Just deal with it now.
I realized that Mrs. Tweedy is the companion of Shrike in Panther Soul as this villainous northern accent, which genuinely I think is one of my favorite villainous performances in anything, because she is such a perfect fit for this film as someone who is motivated by just such grounded things. There's not really a sense of like, oh, she's going to take over the world. The second film goes crazy and a bit more bombastic with it. However, this one, it's just a woman running her chicken farm and she has nothing but disdain for the stock.
He's their leader.
Mr. Tweedy! And they finally have found a way to make us some real money around here. And what are you on about? Ridiculous notions of escaping chickens. It's all in your head, Mr. Tweedy. Say it.
It's all in my head. It's all in my head.
Now, you keep telling yourself that because I don't want to hear another word about it. Is that clear?
Yes, love. But you know that ginger one?
It's chickens, you dolt! Apart from you, they're the most stupid creatures on this planet.
You have the luxury of 1, 2, 3, 4 more chances before I put my own sabre through your heart, Queensbury, and just march us to the next place of rest on our map.
Beatrix glances at Rickish, who shakes his head bravely. Shrike spots this and shrugs.
Do you think for even a moment that I will decide against this tactic?
Her voice echoes around the ruins.
I can assure you that while absolutely everything you care for is going to be taken away if you don't capitulate, I will lose nothing. If we cannot find this treasure for King Louis, we shall simply return to him empty-poured and say it was always a legend. At which point I will inform him that I found and slaughtered the captain of the Crimson Serpent and will receive a shiny new medal to put right here.
She taps the outer breast pocket of her coat, where decorations would usually go.
I shall rest for a month and then be back out on the ocean on our next manoeuvre, while you and your cronies rot underneath the dirt we stand upon.
As she says all this, she has moved herself beside the shuddering leopard, who is squeaking pitifully as she tries to draw in her last breath.
Utterly practical, has no humour in her at all. It's all about the bottom line. And like, from a purely serious capitalist, but also, you know, like, surviving perspective, one can understand why Mrs. Tweedy would be concerned about the farm doing well and by making enough to make ends meet and pay their taxes and everything like that. But when it's done through the subjugation of things that we identify as people, the chickens are other people. They're not just the stock.
Yes.
As it would be easy for humans to consider, oh, they're farm animals. They're there to produce the goods that we need to sell in order to live and everything like that. Mm. Or they're literally the food that we put on the table. But as you point out, the chickens, even when they are ridiculous, feel more human and more relatable than the quote-unquote humans running the farm.
And it is accomplished with one pivotal scene that is probably the furthest they go in any Aardman film. And you definitely have to ask the question of, does this film need to go hard? And I think that whether or not it does, it chooses to in order to make the stakes actually feel real. This is the most tense, dramatic Aardman film, for my money. And it's because of after the opening montage, and one of my favorite opening montages of any film ever, there's going to be a lot of hyperbole from me. I cannot help it, and I will not apologize for it. I set it up at the top. It has one of the biggest effects on me, and if you're coming to me for bias free, I'm the stop motion doctor. I have no bias left. but after that opening montage, which is just so many great visual humor and visual gags, and you don't even hear Ginger's voice really except for a few gasps and grunts until after that montage when she answers Babs's question. And then what is the first event in the film once the film has done its opening prologue and set the scene? Everyone is lined up. What is your service to this location, this settlement? You have not served your community. You have not served me. Through no ambiguous terms, with a silhouette of that same Aardman-style proportions, show Mrs. Tweedy with her totemic object in both this film and the next, gripping that axe and reducing the population by one.
I should put spoilers in the beginning of this episode, FYI.
Yes, absolutely. And it is a character that is barely a character. It is one of the chickens that is named but doesn't really get any speaking roles or any contribution to the scenes previously. The only characterization is just that when Ginger asks Bunty, the chicken that seems to be able to supply so many eggs, like an excess of eggs, she asks, why didn't you give her some of yours to cover it up? And Bunty says, I would have, but she didn't tell me. She didn't tell anyone. For one line, that says a lot. It says that this is someone who just didn't, that couldn't tell anyone. Even when it was life or death, there was a fear that grips this practically nameless chicken. And that's a tone to set the movie at. And as it advances, the desperation to get free is there throughout. The music is always singing of that horizon, that dream of what could be better, a better life for people. Let me come to the point of why I compare this to Princess Thieves and why I think this film has actually gotten better in the intervening decades. This is, to me, maybe not in totality, but at the start of the film, so emphatically, it is a film about someone who feels trapped in an isolated and cut off community, an island, if you will. And the people who run that population, that community, do not have their best interests at heart. They only keep them for as long as they are of use to them. And then as soon as you don't, you are food to fuel them. You have a character who sees all of this and is banging against the walls, is saying, we all need to work to get out of this. And she even says later, We could maybe get one of us out of here, no problem, perhaps even two, but this is about all of us. It is about wanting a better future, not for a closed few. It's not about just benefiting the individual. It is about trying to undo this systemic misjustice and get out of there. Unfortunately, the rest of the population don't have that perspective, will, or that spirit to just actually go for it, at least not at the start. And as soon as she's done with the meeting, Ginger steps out and just has her head in her hands and is saying, like, you are never going to get this group of useless bloody morons out of here. And let me tell you, trapped on this island with a group of people who are under the same governing body that do not give a shit about us, and we keep enabling them, we keep letting, just feeding the feed, and we keep letting it happen, even if it's in our power, if we can get all of us to a better version. You know, we can't fly off to a different place, but there is a version of that. There is a version of this country, this collective of places that can be better. But Mrs. Tweedy still holds the axe against us, and yet I still dream of that brighter horizon.
I was looking forward to this podcast being a fun time, Toby. Thanks for bringing down the mood.
Oh, fuck you. You're talking about Kubo and the Two Strings later.
Yeah, we rewatched that today, and I was just in tears by the end of it, even though I knew it was coming.
I've talked a lot about this. I want to hear you guys' experience. Maureen, I am asking you this question when you're in the middle of eye drops, because that is what a good host does.
Yeah, go for it.
Maureen, had you watched Chicken Run at all before I held the gun at your heads and said, watch the stop motion film about chickens?
No, I had heard about it. I was familiar with Wallace and Gromit. Not that familiar, but like I had seen some clips and whatnot. So I was familiar with the art style, but I'd not seen the movie. And it did kind of take me back, because animated movies are typically viewed as for children. And this, shades of like Auschwitz, like it's a little bit concentration campy. And I was okay, this is a lot of, there's a lot happening here. And I am interested in animation, and I am interested in special effects and virtual effects and all of that stuff, as you and I have talked about, Toby. And I'm more visually focused on movies, which is what, you know, Greg and I have discussed. I am not as familiar with regards to stop motion, but I've seen like Rankin Bass, like all of their Christmas things. So I'm not unfamiliar, like going into some of the other ones that we've seen. I'm aware of like what it is and the kind of work that goes into it. The style of it is very tactile, obviously. That's the point. But it feels like you can like reach in and kind of squish them, because they look like clay. But it also makes it feel very grounded, because it is like a tactile thing. It's not green screen, CGI, tennis balls.
There's a dimensionality to it.
That gives it a little bit more oomph as far as it gives it weight, both literally and metaphorically. So when you say like the opening sequence with the solitary confinement, very funny, but also relatable, because she's the dissenting voice. She's the rebellious one. She is dreaming for more than what they have. And so many people are complacent. So many birds are complacent with their situation and just let it happen to them. And they don't make any effort to change it or go above and beyond, literally above, over the fence. Anyway,
Tried going under the fence and that didn't work. So the plan is we go over it. I can quote the entire film.
I don't doubt that for a second. So and I will just say, speaking as somebody that has worked on a farm and interacted with a lot of chickens. It's not inaccurate. They are.
What did? Are you telling me that they constructed a plane out of their little hen coops?
No, but there is a sort of, they're a little bit more crafty than you would imagine, because people just look at them and they're like, ugh, birds. They're freaking smart and they're kind of vicious.
I told you they was organized.
Like, if one would catch a mouse, then they did. And I did not realize they were carnivores. Boy, howdy. Or omnivores. One would catch a mouse, and then they would all chase him. Because they wanted the mouse. It's bizarre.
They were dinosaurs one time.
I know! So it was very fun to, like, having had the real experience. Also, don't try to kiss them.
I wasn't planning to, but that sounds like you have...
And I ended up bleeding. Because their mouths are very pointy.
Yes.
Anyway, having had like the real experience IRL chicken and then the animated stop motion chicken, it felt more grounded to me. Obviously, they don't talk and they don't organize and they don't knit. But there was some sort of like resonance there of they can be a collective nuisance. They can be a collective... They can be a pack, for lack of a better term, a flock. Flock. Flock is the word, not pack. Flock of chicken. Anyway, and in seeing how they, in the movie, how they are portrayed and how they, you know, work together and everything is, it's fun because it's obviously an
anthropomorphization. That word.
Y'all know what I mean. You see how people... And animals are very similar because they're a lot like chickens, but also they're a lot like humans. So a lot of the behavior of the like sort of group mob mentality and the complacency and the sort of thing like that is not just for, it's not just for the birds. People do the same thing.
It is a film that is on a very sort of, if you take several steps back, it is a film about... kind of rewriting your nature, or like how people's nature kind of simultaneously traps them but can drive them. The Tweedy's natures are interesting because I find Mr. Tweedy, because he's the dog's body, he is the absolute, like, the one who does the patrols and is just kind of going along with it because what are you going to say, stand up to Mrs. Tweedy? No. But he has a conversation where Mrs. Tweedy says, like, we're done with egg production. And he says, no more eggs, but we've always been egg farmers. My father and his father and all their fathers. We was always... And then Mrs. Tweedy interrupts and says, poor, destitute, worthless. It comes across like if he was sort of left uninterrupted, this farm probably wouldn't be as much of a prison camp. Most likely it would be even more in the red than it currently is, but he would probably be just sort of sustaining himself and kind of moving on. And without getting too far into it with the second one, it's revealed that Mrs. Tweedy is no longer, well, Mrs. Tweedy, and Mr. Tweedy doesn't appear. But I think that that's probably the fate that is ahead of him. I get the feeling that Mrs. Tweedy just came in and has seized the control of this and turned it towards something that is becoming industrialized. That is a route that she continues into the second film, and it expands further into cartoonish fashion, but nevertheless, kind of in a strange way, the natural evolution of the path you see her start here. Her nature is different to Mr. Tweedy, where Mr. Tweedy is just sort of kind of fine, just running along with things. And, you know, he'll have his suspicions about them chickens, especially that ginger one. But Mrs. Tweedy's nature is to, like, grow beyond her station. She is uncontent with what the world has put in her lap. And so she will grow and try to become more and more Whereas the chickens, their nature is just to sort of go along with the flock until it isn't.
I hadn't thought about this until you started.
You're going to say what I'm thinking. Go for it.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about this until you started along this line, which is that there's a certain irony in the fact that Mr. Tweedy has more in common with the chickens than he does with Mrs. Tweedy.
That isn't what I was going to say. I was going to say that Ginger and Mrs. Tweedy are sort of opposite side of the same coin. Because they both want more for themselves.
Yes, actually, very true. And the second film has, like, I do not mean to give away too much, but I can't help but talk about some of my favorite moments where in the second film, there is this sort of feeling that Ginger has PTSD and the next generation wants more, but Ginger has fought so much to gain freedom that she is actually not the same freedom fighter that she once was, because she had to fight so hard to get it and she fears losing it, which I think is a really great direction to go with that. But when Mrs. Tweedy re-enters the picture, there is this feeling that they are mortal enemies. And it's not just that Mrs. Tweedy forgot about which one. She remembers that fucking chicken. And when she sees it, it's like, I do not care how much I need to invest in this. I am going to kill that fucking chicken.
Hashtag relatable to the PTSD part. But yeah.
To respond to the wall of text you've just thrown at me here.
You want wall of text? I've got chapters, motherfucker.
Giant book. Funk.
That's your pre-reading.
You asked me at one point how much of Aardman I'd seen apart from Chicken Run. I have watched the entirety of The Wrong Trousers to date. I've only seen little bits and pieces of some of the other ones you're talking about, like The Were-Rabbit.
The Wrong Trousers is one of the greatest pieces of art that we as a civilization have produced.
But in experiencing that particular Aardman, what immediately came across and actually makes it stand out and be a bit different from Chicken Run is that much of the content and also much of the comedy involved is a purely visual medium. So it uses the strengths of Aardman's stop motion work to its fullest extent when it's going through the whole process of not just the part where the penguin is shooting at the dog and they're both riding around on model trains. This is the part that everyone has seen if they've ever seen any Aardman.
Is that a penguin? He's got a gun! Blam, blam, blam.
But just the whole experience of like, the way that sequence opens and how the dog is investigating what's going on with the penguin, the entire thing that happens with...
He has a name, Greg.
Yes, I couldn't tell you if it's Wallace or Gromit.
You and I have led very different lives, sir.
Don't worry, it's not going to be the last time you're angry at me during this recording.
Oh, no!
But
we call that foreshadowing, kids.
The heist scene is very compelling to watch and uses both like tension and comedy in equal measure to tell its story, even as it's doing things with the medium, which make even me go like, how did they do that? When they like animate the penguin sweating because things are going wrong.
Clear plastic, lower glue in some instance that they just put down. Like, there's a bit where you see in Matter of Life and Death where you see Gromit, the dog, coming in from the rain, and he is covered with rain. And they use a mixture of CGI and physical globules that are stuck to his model.
By comparison, although there are plenty of memorable visuals, particularly as they're doing the process of like establishing the farm, being like Auschwitz, that early cinematic that you're mentioning being like a comedy version of The Great Escape. And then the juxtaposition with that first major, oh no, this is deadly serious. They're taking the bird off to get the axe. having seen the entirety of The Wrong Trousers sort of prepares me for the fact that Aardman can do drama and comedy in equal measure.
Hmm. I'd honestly like to see them do more drama, and their recent output has indicated that they are branching out with more productions underway.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should add the Shaun the Sheep movies to our list, because the second one is called Farmageddon, and I do enjoy that pun.
Yes. The Shaun the Sheep material was exactly what I was going to get into, but I would like to save that for when Greg has finished his point.
Yeah.
Hurry up.
As I was saying.
Yeah, I can take half an hour, and then the rest of you just have to take 2 minutes to get your... What am I, Hideo Kojima at the Game Awards?
Oh my gosh.
As I was saying, the thing about Chicken Run is that for all of those visuals, for all of the dramatic parts of the animation and the comedy parts of the animation, it's far more dialogue focused, because the relationships are very important, not just the juxtaposition of the humor and the drama, but also, as you were talking about, the very British nature of the comedy. So therefore, the way everybody is acting, there is definitely some stereotypical portrayals going on there in terms of the types of characters, but it all fits very neatly, I feel, into the tone that they are trying to set up and why Ginger is so different from all of the other characters. Not just different from the other birds, but like why she has a vibrancy and a life to her. And just a sort of a sight on the big picture, like even Rocky, when he comes in with his own worldliness and his own experiences, doesn't have the same level of, like, he comes around to her way of thinking, but he's still very much about, you know, finding fun and excitement and what and freedom wherever he can, and therefore more than happy to play up his celebrity role to all of the other chickens in the farm and everything like that, where Ginger always has her eyes on the prize, so to speak.
Because he has freedom, but no responsibility, which Ginger wants freedom, but not without shirking her responsibilities.
And she's carrying the responsibility for everybody else because nobody takes it as seriously as she does.
Precisely.
It even takes... The one that's supposedly in the RAF, that was Fowler?
Fowler, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Even he, with all of his serious, is sort of a bit ridiculous. And so therefore, he...
No one pays attention to him throughout the film because he's just the local old guy who was in World War II. And the film...
Respect your veterans! Sorry.
Yeah. It keeps it quite nebulous what time this is set in, because there are a lot of things that are quite antiquated, but it's also set on a farm that is away from a populated center, which means that there are places you can go to where it looks like you're looking at the first half of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because, like, yeah, this farm just kind of still operates with that. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the key things that I like about this film the most, is that Ginger sort of instills in everybody else, helping them to complete through their own arcs by not just trying to impress the seriousness of the situation, but by trusting them, each of them, to do what they do best. Even when Fowler admits, oh no, I was a mascot, I don't actually know how to do all of these things. And but she's like, but you're the only one that has an inkling of an idea. I am going to trust in you to use anything that you have in order to help us escape. Just like she invests some of that in Rocky, you need to teach us how to do this, until obviously he escapes and that falls through. But she's like, Mac, you're good at doing what you do. I want you to focus your eye on that. Babs, I know that you're always doing your knitting. Fine. Then you're going to knit for the cause. You're going to help us put this thing together, doing what you do best.
Bunty is the means of production. And they shall seize the means of production.
And it's kind of shocking how all of this ridiculousness comes together in a pinch when we happen to. Because even when we introduce the rats, who clearly feel like they're just taking advantage of the situation, when they are made a part of the collective, and I'm glad to see that they've returned for the sequel, because I ended up liking them a lot more than I thought I would.
Oh, they're great.
There's just a level of heart to all of it that made me enjoy it more than I would. Like, I was worried that the ridiculousness would overshadow everything, but at the end of the day, all of the pieces seem to work really well together to make it, at the end, go, yeah, okay, that was a good use of my time.
As a side note, Maureen and I have recently been watching Ghosts, which is a sitcom involving some living people inheriting an old house that happens to have a lot of ghosts on the property, and one of the living couple can hear and talk to them. This was one of those comedies like The Office that had a version in the UK and was transplanted to the States. The reason I bring that up is that for a comedy, it also often taps into a level of both drama and sincerity that is similar to what Chicken Run does.
It's an hour and 20 minutes. How is it that short?
Yeah, they do pack a lot into that short amount of time, it feels. But it also means that they're very, not practical. What's the word I'm looking for?
Efficient?
Efficient, yes. Maureen knows how much I love efficiency. And so therefore, there is not a lot of wasted space in Chicken Run.
Well, a lot of these you can't, right? Because
yeah, you can't really.
Hey, if you add an extra minute to any of these films, that is a week, if not weeks, of people's working time. That's why storyboarding is so important is in any film, let alone something where every second counts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so happy to hear you guys talk about your experience with it because, like I said, it's very personal to me, but I do think it's one of those films that gets a bit lost in the catalogue of Aardman sometimes because there's just so much higher profile stuff that they have. Yeah, I love it.
It's one of those things where if you give it a chance, you will be rewarded by the experience.
I think so.
My biggest problem with Aardman, unfortunately, as my lead-in was talking about the aesthetic, the overall structure of, I think Aardman is excellent for portraying chickens in particular. I think they've got the sculpting of that down pat. My problem with Aardman has always been the faces. The too wide mouth on the too small face. And I know everyone has their own level of what's uncanny valley to them and everything like that. The stylization of people talking and, you know, the way their lips move and the way their teeth are shown in Aardman has always been a little bit of a turnoff for me, which is why the parts of Aardman I always liked the most was literally just when they're running around with the trains for the wrong trousers and just the ridiculous physical comedy of that entire thing. No one needs to be talking for that, so it can't distract me from enjoying what's on display. So I was surprised when I got involved with some of the proper emotionality of Chicken Run, and they're able to create expressions even on the chickens' faces that conveyed the right kind of emotional mood to go with the setup.
I think that's a very astute observation, because something that occurred to me while we were talking is that what this film, and I think a lot of the films, and especially Leica's output, impress with their stop motion is the willingness to have close-up shots, like very close-up shots, because the choice of shot determines what kind of model you use. If it's a far away shot, you are using much smaller and less detailed models so that they can traverse a wider shot more easily. However, if it's a close-up shot, then they will use much bigger models so that they can animate it. But it's a rough place because everything's on show. Bits where the camera suddenly zooms in to Ginger and Rocky when they're at the dance and Rocky is on the cusp of telling her the truth, and you see the various thoughts and emotions flicker across his face. They have to sculpt that. They have to do something with it. And then later, when she goes into the hut, sees that he is gone, and unfolds the missing scrap, and the camera zooms in, trusting that this inanimate object that they are manipulating can convey the sort of Simpsons meme of, and you can pinpoint the moment where her heart snaps in two. How do they do that with an armature with a bit of plasticine around it that is for a fucking chicken? It's a simple enough idea. We can anthropomorphize anything.
You know what makes humans different from other animals?
Feet.
No. Come on, bears have feet.
We're the only species on Earth that observes Shark Week. Sharks don't even observe Shark Week, but we do. For the same reason, I can pick up this pencil, tell you its name is Steve, and go like this. Oh. And part of you dies, just a little bit on the inside, because people can connect with anything. We can sympathize with a pencil, we can forgive a shark, and we can give Ben Affleck an Academy Award for screenwriting.
Big mistake.
But, you know, when you take a step back, it is astonishing that they are willing to go against some of the lessons that, you know, anyone who works in this medium probably gets taught from day one. It's a bit like how people talk about in animation, they'll say you need to keep, in the early days, they would keep static shots because you can't move and keep the characters animating and keep the perspective. It's all just complicates it exponentially. And yet, in examples like this and so many other studios, they choose to find their own solutions to it. And that embracing that challenge means, first of all, that they grow as artists, but secondly, for the product, for the story, it takes you to unfamiliar places of expression that just makes those narrative beats hit harder.
We're going to talk a lot more about how faces, but also physical acting, can convey the right amount of emotionality when we talk about Kubo. And it feels
I thought you were going to talk about, say, when we talk about God of War.
Another show.
God of War, unfortunately, doesn't get as many points in this because the technology that allows for performance capture means that they are able to accurately portray something that the actor is providing in an animated setting. No. The work done in stop motion in order to accomplish that, that feels like it's 10 times harder because it's not technology doing the work, even if it took a lot to create that technology.
Daniel Floyd of Playframe and New Frame Plus says it very well, where he has talked in various videos about how animators have to be actors. They have to act, because if they don't, then the motion doesn't sell. The expression doesn't sell. It is a collaborative performance. And it's just always amazing to me the moments when, a lot of the time in animated films, when we're talking about what you are drawn to, the dialogue, that's collaboration, because a voice actor is doing their best to supply the emotion in pure audio form, and then that's married to the motion of lines on a sheet of paper or a solid stop motion model, and it's collaborative. But in the moments when it's dialogue less, where it really is just the animation in a vacuum that has to convey it, that always feels like a magic trick to me, and it always will.
Yeah. I don't feel like I have a lot more to say about Chicken Run. What the thing I took away from it overall was that this was, honestly, to a certain extent, a very basic story that lives or dies in the work that all the artists, including the voice actors, put into making a well-worn story exciting in and of itself. I don't know that I'd watch this movie again. I think I might, if only to like compare and contrast with the sequel, which I will eventually watch. I've seen the trailer now, and it looks fucking ridiculous.
I think you mean what we will eventually watch.
Oh, yes. most of the things I watch are with you, sweetie. I include you in that.
Oh, it must be nice having your spouse in the same location to watch stuff. How is that?
Hey, for the first part of our relationship, we weren't.
That's fair. You've done your innings. You've done your time.
We've waited 16 long years in Azkaban. Sorry, no, wrong.
I'm glad to have this as a further frame, because at this point, I've seen like maybe a handful of stop motion animation where the craft is something I would take literally seriously. Like Maureen, I've watched a lot of Rankin Bass, but like she mentioned earlier, most of the time when I think of stop motion, I think of it as something that is purely kid-focused. And so therefore, the idea of having the kind of serious stories that I enjoy the most taking place within that milieu is not something I would normally expect. And I like having it as a contrast point against some of the other celebrated works that are out there.
And that's part one done. I was having trouble with part two of our music discussion, so I decided to work on this instead and had a much easier time. So next time, you'll get to hear a complicated back and forth on The Nightmare Before Christmas, which I still think the School of Movies show did more thoroughly and cohesively, but at least you'll finally get to hear one way or another who wins in a verbal punch-up between me and Toby. To close us out, an old 50s blues song by Big Joe Turner, covered and reimagined slightly as a swing version for the purpose of Chicken Run, putting it alongside other big hits of the 90s like Zoot Suit Riot and Jump, Jive, and Wail. Until next time, this is Flip, Flop, and Fly.
And a new gold tooth. Here comes my baby flashing a new gold tooth. Well, she's so small she can run me in a paper moon. That's the truth.